Capital Report is underwritten in part by Hopping Green and Sam's, saluting its client, the City of Tallahassee, for its support of animal welfare activities. I'm Ralph DeMeo of Hopping Green and Sam's Law Firm.
The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire someone with a disability. More information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of abilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, because people want to work. And from the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, supporting nutritious lunches in Florida schools with more fresh fruits and vegetables, whole grains, and other healthy choices, encouraging kids to choose school lunch. More at freshforfloridakids.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
After 2 years of staunch opposition to the federal health care law, Florida's Republican leaders are reluctantly coming around.
And this is a law that's been deemed constitutional, and we will faithfully implement it, but we want to do so in a way that provides the most choices and the least cost to Floridians.
While many are working to address the state's recent problems in the election, some are at odds over how to improve Florida's electoral process.
The truth of the matter is we don't need any more task forces. We done task force and study groups this issue and other issues to death. What we need is action.
Latino voters get credit for a number of important Florida Democrat wins, and some say it's too early to tell what impact the outcome of the election will have on business. I'm Regan McCarthy, and that's all coming up on Capitol Report. After more than 2 years of opposition to the federal health care overhaul law, Florida's Republican leaders are now saying they plan to take it up in the upcoming legislative session. That's a reversal, of course, for many Republicans who were staunch opponents to the law, including Governor Rick Scott. But as Lynn Hatter reports, the state's change of tone doesn't mean Florida will be ready to meet looming deadlines, and it still leaves the fate of several of the law's programs and provisions up in the air.
Florida lawmakers will have to decide whether to set up online insurance marketplaces and whether to expand the state's Medicaid program for low-income people. Both programs are part of the Federal Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. And for more than 2 years, Florida Republicans have rejected the programs as government intrusion and overreach. Incoming Senate President Don Gates was one of them, but he now says the U.S. Supreme Court and the voters have spoken, and the health care overhaul is the law of the land.
And now, on the 20th of November, Speaker Weatherford and I will take oaths to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution and the laws of the United States. And this is a law that's been deemed constitutional, and we will faithfully implement it, but we want to do so in a way that provides the most choices and the least cost to Floridians.
Florida now has until December to tell the federal government whether it will create its own health insurance exchange. But state leaders like Gates and incoming House Speaker Will Weatherford say they won't be ready.
There are hundreds of unanswered questions that are out there with regard to the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And until we have the answers to those questions, we don't know which plan gives our consumers the most choices.
If states don't set up their own exchanges, the federal government will do so in their place. There's also an option for a federal and state partnership. But Florida may already have two models for a new exchange: Florida Health Choices, an online marketplace for individuals and small businesses, and Florida Healthy Kids, which is used for the state's Medicaid program for children. Both are online marketplaces where consumers can shop and compare plans. That's just what's envisioned for the federal health insurance exchanges. And Senator Gates says Florida is seriously considering Florida Health Choices and Healthy Kids as vehicles to establishing a state and federal partnership exchange that would comply with federal law.
We think that there is a possibility, at least, that through the existing exchanges that we've set up, that a partnership with the federal government could result in some cost savings and could result in some additional options to Florida families.
Meanwhile, state leaders are still mulling over whether to expand its $21 billion Medicaid program to cover low-income people who earn up to 133% of the federal poverty line. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled that expansion is optional for states, and Florida Legal Services attorney Ann Swerlick says the ruling blew a big hole in health care law.
And that's because the lowest income people, people at or below 100% of poverty, the way the law is currently structured, they are not eligible to go out on the exchanges and purchase insurance and get premium assistance.
But state officials remain concerned about the financial impact of adding more people to the state's Medicaid program. For the first few years of the expansion, the federal government would shoulder all of the additional costs. The support drops to about 90%, with the state picking up 10% in the out years. And that's something that concerns researchers like Thomas Perrin, who works at Florida's James Madison Institute, a conservative-leaning think tank.
So it's almost a bait and switch just to kind of get more states on board, I think. But I think more and more states that go along with that are going to have an extremely difficult time in keeping up with the increased cost of Medicaid once the feds start removing some of the help that they're going to provide initially.
State estimates put the cost at about $500 million a year by 2020 to support another 2 million Floridians who would be eligible for the program under the expansion. But other reports, like a recent study from Georgetown University, has found that the state could actually save money. Incoming House Speaker Will Weatherford says there are still too many unknowns.
I'll give you an example. There are some people who are asking, if you want to opt into the Medicaid expansion, do you have to do it universal across all lines? Does it have to be 133% for every person who qualifies for Medicaid? Or can you do it for certain populations? Or can you go to 115% or 120%?
Another big issue with Medicaid is doctor reimbursement rates. Many physicians don't take Medicaid patients because current reimbursement rates are so low they lose money. The law gives primary care doctors a pay increase, but that's only for the first 2 years. Meanwhile, Florida hospitals are on pins and needles because under the law, they've agreed to take rate cuts in exchange for getting more people insured. Florida Legal Services Ann Swerlick says hospitals and other caregivers could get burned if Florida doesn't expand Medicaid.
Our health care delivery system is going to be in a world of hurt without having that funding and not doing a Medicaid expansion.
Meanwhile, Governor Rick Scott says he too plans on submitting a letter to the federal government asking for more information on both the Medicaid expansion and the health insurance exchanges. Scott says he wants to sit down with the federal government and negotiate. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Between long lines at several Florida polling locations, delayed ballot counts, and late results, Florida's been called embarrassing and has become the butt of many election jokes. Now the governor and state elections officials are looking into what could be done to improve the state's elections process. But as Sasha Cordner reports, some say that's not enough.
In the week following the election, there's been a lot of talk about election reform in Florida. Some Floridians had to wait hours before getting a chance to vote, and a few counties did not report their ballot results right away. Some blame the governor for his refusal to extend early voting days. Others are criticizing the Republican-led legislature for passing a law last year that critics called the Voter Suppression Act. And there are those who are pointing the finger at several local county election supervisors. There's a lot of blame going around, but one thing most parties can agree on is Florida's current election process needs some improvement.
Your state government ought to be doing the exact same that you have to do, that businesses have to do. And whenever you finish a project, in this case an election, let's go back and look. What went right? Constantly look at how can we improve things for you, the citizens of the state? How can we make sure we do it cost effectively?
Governor Rick Scott has already charged Florida Department of State Secretary Ken Detzner to meet with county election supervisors to get feedback and ideas. They recently had their first meeting, and Ron Lebaski with the Florida State Association of Supervisors says their next meeting is slated for December, with both Detzner and the county supervisors doing some fact-finding.
Rather than proceeding on assumptions of what happened and what may have contributed to some of the issues that had been cited, particularly by, you know, in the press stories, that we know exactly what may have transpired in these counties that had issues and what we would see maybe that would be comparable in other counties that mitigated those instances of lines or people having to wait for several hours to vote.
Meanwhile, advocacy groups like the League of Women Voters say the governor as well as the state's elected leader should go further by setting up a bipartisan election reform task force. The league's president, Deirdre McNabb, points to what happened in the 2000 presidential election when problems in Florida's election process surfaced.
Year 2000, another election fiasco. Then Governor Jeb Bush formed a task force just like the one we're calling for, bipartisan trusted leaders. And almost all of the recommendations made by that task force were implemented during either his tenure or Republican Governor Charlie Crist, who followed him. We saw the institution of early voting for the first time. We saw new machinery that was reliable. You know, so we made really very critical steps forward.
The truth of the matter is we don't need any more task forces. We done task forced and study grouped this issue and other issues to death. What we need is action.
Representative Daryl Rousson says the sort of action that should be taken is trying to actively reverse the changes of what he calls a bad elections bill. The Democrat says the state's current elections law is what contributed to Florida's election troubles. And to move the state forward, he says he filed a comprehensive election reform bill. It includes returning the number of early voting days back to 14 and increasing the number of early voting sites.
October 17th of this year, I filed a bill in bill drafting because I had heard from the constituents. I'd heard from the grassroots organizations, the get out to vote movements, that we were going to have problems when this election rolled around. And so my bill is designed to take us back to some solutions.
Rousson says he's had both Democrats and Republicans reach out to him, and he's also been talking to incoming House Speaker Will Weatherford, who he says shares his outrage at what happened. And Weatherford says this year he's bringing back the Committee on Ethics and Elections. He says he hopes with the public's help, along with input from elected state and local officials, the group can find out why this happened and what more the legislature needs to do.
It's not a good thing when it's Friday, 3 days after the election, and every state in the country is either red or blue, and there's one of them that's yellow because they haven't counted the votes yet and decided where the 29 electoral votes are going. I think that's something that we should be embarrassed by and something we should make sure going forward doesn't happen again. But I think what you'll see is through that Ethics and Elections Committee, us look for ways to solve that problem and make sure that we don't find ourselves in that situation again.
And if it's found that last year's election law is to blame for the state's current election problems, Weatherford says,
certainly, if it contributed to any challenges in the elections process, we should admit that. I don't think we have the facts yet to determine if that was the case.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Still to come on Capitol Report, Latino voters set a record-breaking turnout for the 2012 elections, helping President Obama and other Democrats claim victory across the state.
Now we see that the community is active. They say the sleeping giant, well, we're wide awake.
Following the outcome of the election, some say it's bad news for business, while others say it could be a good thing.
Businesses thrive when the communities that they function in are in good shape.
And advocates are trying to get Florida's attorney general to legalize medical marijuana, but some experts say the state shouldn't decriminalize smoking the raw marijuana plant.
Do medical marijuana the right way, which would be non-smoked components, delivered in a pharmacy, doctor's care. Not a 25-year-old kid with no medical background telling you to buy Super Silver Haze for your cancer.
Analysts say President Barack Obama owes a big thank you to Latino voters, who many say made up a big chunk of his Florida win. That comes as a surprise to pollsters who predicted a Romney win. But as Thomas Andrew Gustafson reports for grassroots organizers in Florida, it wasn't a surprise at all.
Florida Democratic Party Chairman Rod Smith says it was a major party focus to get out the Latino vote, beginning as early as 2010. And Democrats focused mostly on Latinos in Central Florida.
It was clear when you had analyzed the numbers that we had left huge amounts of votes out there that should have been Democratic votes. So it was clear basically working the I-4 corridor, primarily focusing on the Hispanic outreach in Orange, Osceola, Seminole, and Polk, which we knew could be real game changers.
Julissa Arson with the voter advocacy group Mi Familia Vota says the Latino population has grown dramatically throughout Central Florida, and she believes the group's outreach in the area paid off big.
I believe that we are the determining factor in the presidential election.
Only two Central Florida counties, Osceola and Orange, went for President Barack Obama. But throughout the state, Obama carried 75% of the Latino vote, according to the research group Latino Decisions. That's the highest Latino support of any presidential candidate ever. And Kathy Bird with the Florida Immigrant Coalition says that shows the direction of the changing electorate as issues with citizenship and deportation take to a bigger stage.
Our vote can no longer be taken for granted, and the issues that we care about can no longer be taken for granted. And, you know, we're really hoping that this is going to help legislators at every level of government, that we want to see particular changes happen.
And Arson says Latino voters are taking stances on more than immigration issues.
We all want better jobs. We all want equal education for our children, health care. That really drove out the masses to make that difference.
Arson says the goal now is to increase the Latino voter turnout by explaining the importance of voting in the 2014 elections.
Now we see that the community is active, right? They say the sleeping giant, well, we're wide awake. So now it's just getting the information out there, educating the community. Voting doesn't just come every 4 years. You have elections every 2 years, and those are just as important.
Florida Democratic Chairman Rod Smith agrees.
I think that the changing demographic of Florida was never more evident, and we, or at least this cycle, we adjusted to it well, and we took advantage of it, and now what we've got to do is maintain the momentum and maintain a consistency in that effort.
Smith says the work done in this election laid the groundwork for future success. And though the voter turnout may not have the boost of a presidential election in 2 years, he says it's not that hard to imagine another big victory if Democrats keep up the work. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Thomas Andrew Gustafson.
Before the election, officials from both sides of the aisle and almost every level of government touted their plan for business and job growth. Pollsters said the economy was many voters' top priority, and campaigns made sure to highlight how the decisions voters made at the polls would affect Florida businesses. For example, during a campaign bus tour, Florida Congressman Steve Sutherland raised concerns about keeping Democrats in office, saying the party wasn't working to cut down on regulation.
The president would say that's job creation. We're creating bureaucrats to come regulate you, to come challenge you and haunt you.
But now that the election's over, how will business fare? Well, that depends on who you ask. Karen Woodall with the Florida Center for Fiscal and Economic Policy says her group thinks business, particularly small and medium businesses, will fare quite well, especially since several state amendments were defeated.
In reality, some of the amendments that were on the ballot, particularly Amendments 3 and Amendment 4, would have had a severe impact on revenues, and our analysis shows that that would have resulted in layoffs, in cutting of funds for education, for health care, for child care.
And Woodall says that wouldn't have made a good environment for business growth.
Businesses thrive when the communities that they function in are in good shape. Layoffs don't help business owners. It means people don't have money in their pocket to purchase their products or purchase their services.
And Woodall adds one of the biggest outcomes of the election is a continuing conversation about a fair tax system. She says when voters decided to keep President Obama in the White House and gave more seats to Democrats, that was proof they wanted legislative leaders to have a conversation about what she calls a more balanced tax approach. But on the other hand, Joe Berg has a different take. Berg is the president of Shop Local Tallahassee, a local business promotion group in the state's capital. From an anecdotal perspective, he says what he's noticed is that the uncertainty that often comes with an election isn't good for business.
Things slow down right before an election, especially really tight elections. And I think it starts at the top and it goes all the way down to the bottom. A lot of people don't know what their tax liability is going to be next year, so they're hesitant to invest or to hire. And you see this right before the election, the months before. Hiring slows down, manufacturing slows down. Everybody's just waiting to see which way the egg is going to roll off the top of the roost.
And now Berg says he worries the conversation about things like the fiscal cliff and the Bush tax cuts might bring enough uncertainty to keep people's wallets in their pockets. But despite Berg's concerns, Rick McAllister with the Florida Retail Federation says consumer spending is on the rise.
Americans are feeling more confident about their own financial situation, about their ability to find a job should, God forbid, something not good happen to theirs. Their 401ks and their retirement plans are looking better than they were 3 years ago. The housing starts, the housing values are all looking better to them, and all those things add up to a consumer who's more willing to spend.
No matter what view a person takes on the issue, most agree the state of business in Florida is likely to fluctuate. But what that means and what direction it will take remains to be seen. Florida's October unemployment numbers are showing a modest dip in the state's unemployment rate. Ryan Bank reports the Florida Department of Economic Opportunity says the seasonally adjusted number is the lowest since December of 2008.
Florida's unemployment rate has dropped 0.2 points from 8.7 to 8.5%. Although the overall rate has dropped, the growth of the private sector has slowed. Florida's chief economist Rebecca Russ says she expects private sector jobs to continue growing as retailers add temporary positions for the holidays. She adds job seekers shouldn't discount the possibility of temporary jobs.
We really encourage job seekers that they do apply for jobs even though they're seasonal, because always a portion of those jobs do remain permanent.
Professional and business services added the most jobs with a gain of more than 25,000 positions. The state has added more than 170,000 private sector jobs since 2010. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Bank.
And Florida's economy is also seeing a boost from tourism for the 30th consecutive month, putting the state on track toward a record year. According to preliminary estimates released by Visit Florida, the state's official tourism marketing company, the state saw an increase in visitors from the U.S. and abroad during the third quarter of 2012. Visit Florida President Will Seckham says compared with the same time period in 2011, 3.5% more visitors came to Florida. And that means the state was able to add 15,000 jobs since this time last year.
If you look at nearly every county in the state, tourism is at the top of the rung in terms of the economic impact to the communities. And that happens not just in the summer, but it happens really year-round.
Seckham also says from January to August, tourism and recreation sales increased 7.5% to $49 billion. Part of that increase can be attributed to a 4% increase in visitors from Canada. You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Regan McCarthy. And finally, it's been tried before in Florida and failed, but this week an advocacy group is working on a new way to make medical marijuana legal in the state. As Jessica Palumbo reports, the group wants to get the drug reclassified as a less dangerous substance, a path they're hoping will lead to doctors being able to prescribe it in Florida.
Days after voters in Colorado and Washington approved the legalization of small amounts of recreational marijuana, Florida's Attorney General Pam Bondi got a petition asking her to decriminalize marijuana, known as cannabis, for medical use here. Bondi spokesman John Lucas says the Attorney General hasn't indicated what she'll decide.
Well, the Attorney General's office received the petition on Tuesday. We're still reviewing the document and have not yet responded to the petition.
Florida law gives Bondi 30 days to respond to the request filed by the Florida Cannabis Action Network. It's the same group that supported failed efforts in the past to put medical marijuana on the ballot. But Executive Director Jody James says the group's new tactic has never been tried before.
This is good public policy, and it's something that this is the right way to do it. By calling on the Attorney General to act, this is what the legislature has said they want to happen first, and as soon as she acts, then I feel confident that the legislature will protect patients who are sick and dying in Florida.
The advocates are asking Bondi to change the cannabis classification to something below Schedule 1, the category reserved for the most dangerous drugs, including meth and heroin. James says the federal definition of Schedule 1 is something that has no medical purpose and a high potential for abuse, and that doesn't describe cannabis. Just ask Fort Lauderdale financial advisor Irvin Rosenfeld.
I've been using it in Florida, you know, for 27 years now.
He's one of just four people in the U.S. participating in an experimental federal program that started in the early 80s. He says the National Institute on Drug Addiction grows marijuana plants at the University of Mississippi.
The whole plant is shipped to Raleigh, North Carolina, where it's broken down, moisture's taken out, and it's put in cigarette form by a cigarette machine, and they put 300 cigarettes together in a tin can that you saw. That's how I receive it from the federal government every 25 days.
The federal program was dissolved in 1992, but Rosenfeld and other participants were allowed to continue. He qualified because of a rare bone tumor disorder. At nearly 60 years old, he says smoking marijuana is the only thing his doctor credits for his long remission. Doctors prescribe it for everything from glaucoma to terminal cancer. 18 other states and the District of Columbia have legalized its medicinal use. But the University of Florida's Drug Policy Institute director, Dr. Kevin Sabet, says legalization advocates are wrong.
They must be smoking something. The scientific consensus is undisputable.
Sabet is a former senior advisor in the Obama administration Drug Policy Office. He says there's no basis for Bondi to remove marijuana from the Schedule 1 list.
That definition simply means that the whole raw marijuana plant is not medical and it has a high potential for abuse. And that is a technical criteria that is true.
He says the component ingredients of cannabis do have medicinal value, but they're already available in pill form. And he says a cannabis mouth spray is going through approval testing by the FDA. But what is the harm in allowing doctors to prescribe and monitor smoked marijuana? Sabet says states like California show that opens the door to widespread use and abuse.
Do medical marijuana the right way, which would be non-smoked components delivered in a pharmacy, doctor's care, not a 25-year-old kid with no medical background telling you to buy super silver haze for your cancer.
In Florida, people who are arrested for growing or possessing marijuana can use a medical necessity defense in court if their doctor is willing to testify on their behalf. But for longtime users like Cannabis Action Network President Catherine Jordan, who lives with Lou Gehrig's disease, that's not good enough. Speaking through an interpreter, she says her goal has always been not to be a criminal.
Florida has a medical necessity.
Florida has a medical necessity defense. But I had to be arrested to use it. This is a life and death situation for me, and I do have a right to life.
Attorney General Bondi could choose to change the classification for marijuana, leaving it up to the legislature to pass new regulations, or she could refuse the group's request. Finally, she could open up the issue to public input before making a decision. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Tom Flanagan, Lynn Hatter, and Jessica Palumbo. Thanks also to public radio stations from around the state. Taylor Cox provided technical assistance for Capital Report. And I'm Regan McCarthy, inviting you to join us next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capital Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capital Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org.
Capital Report is underwritten in part by Hopping Green and Sam's, saluting its client, the City of Tallahassee, for its support of animal welfare activities. I'm Ralph DeMeo of Hopping Green and Sam's Law Firm.
The Able Trust. Helping donors make a difference through planned giving. Putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, because people want to work. And from the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, supporting nutritious lunches in Florida schools with more fresh fruits and vegetables, whole grains, and other healthy choices, encouraging kids to choose school lunch. More at freshforfloridakids.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.